Hi there, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Julia Charlton, a Hong Kong lawyer and partner of Charlton's, a Hong Kong corporate finance law firm. Thank you very much for joining us today. I'm really excited to be here, and we're going to hear about the development and the current state of play regarding crypto regulation in the UAE. It's amazing that we have with us today two experts in the crypto regulatory world from the UAE. Jahanzeb Aiwan is the founder of J. Aiwan and Partners. It's an advisory firm with offices in Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Riyadh, Karachi, Doha, Toronto, and London. Together with his colleague, Dapo Akko, who is a managing director in the compliance and risk management practice of J. Aiwan and Partners, and is also the head of the Abu Dhabi office and the firm's virtual assets practice. So Jahanzeb and Dapo will give an overview of the UAE crypto markets for service providers, and then we'll deep dive into discussion. So why is the UAE so interesting in the crypto world? Well, according to a recent PwC report, the Middle East is one of the fastest growing crypto markets in the world, making up 7% of global trading volumes. And reportedly, the UAE's share of the global market is around $25 billion. With transactions, and it increased between July 2020 and June 2021, apparently by 500%. Regionally, the UAE ranks third by volume behind Turkey, which had 132 billion in transaction volume, and close to Lebanon at 26 billion. Just last month, a study by the United Emirates telecoms regulator, the Telecoms and Digital Government Regulatory Authority, said that 11.4% of UAE residents own or have invested in cryptocurrencies, ranking it amongst the top 10 countries in the world in terms of resident crypto usage and investment. So while the key reason for the high rate of crypto adoption in Turkey and Lebanon is value preservation, for the UAE, the increase in transaction volume is multifactorial. There's a number of growth factors. While official figures are unavailable, National News, a local daily, said that there are around 400 crypto businesses currently in the UAE. But I'm sure we'll hear more about their views from Jahanzeb and Dapo about that. And Ahmed bin Sulaym, executive chairman and CEO of the Dubai Blockchain Center, said that he's confident that there will be well over 1,000 crypto businesses in the UAE by the end of 2022. So it's super exciting to hear from the two experts we have with us today. And I'll say something about them, and then we will move to, they will then do a presentation, and then we'll have a discussion and Q&A session. So Jahanzeb Aiwan, he has had a career spanning over 23 years. He advises clients on a wide range of initiatives, regulatory issues, and multi-billion dollar transactions. He's done that in the Middle East and North Africa, US, Europe, and Asia. Jahanzeb is the founding partner and chief executive of his firm and is responsible for overall business development. He's also the chief client officer responsible for managing key regulatory and client relationships. Prior to establishing his firm, he was the regional head of compliance for Morgan Stanley's business in the MENA region, and prior to that was head of compliance for the National Bank of Dubai. Jahanzeb started his career with Hornblower and Weeks in New York and subsequently worked with Raymond James and Associates in Philadelphia. He's currently advising several large international, regional and UAE institutions on compliance and risk matters. He has long-standing relationships with the key regulators in the region and frequently advises on matters of regulatory policies. He has a BSc degree, magna cum laude, from the University of Arizona. He's a member of the International Compliance Association and the Association of Certified Anti-Money Laundering Specialists. Now, Dapo Akko, as I mentioned earlier, Dapo is Managing Director in the Compliance and Risk Management Practice of the firm and also head of the Abu Dhabi office and the firm's virtual assets practice. He has over 20 years' experience in the financial services industry, with the last 13 years spent in risk and compliance roles for the UK regulator, the FSA, now the FCA, and two leading financial institutions, UBS and Lloyds. As a firm supervisor at the FSA's retail firms division, he led and delivered several risk assessments by adopting appropriate methodologies to determine and ensure financial soundness. His roles at UBS cut across IB trade surveillance monitoring. He was team lead for EMEA employee compliance, responsible for managing employee conflicts of interest, and was an executive director overseeing the conduct risk change program. This is breathtaking. In between his roles at UBS, he spent 18 months at Lloyd's assessing the mis-selling of interest rate derivatives to retail customers. Dapo has a bachelor's and a master's degree in economics and an MBA from Imperial College London. He's an associate member of the Professional Risk Managers International Association. All seriously impressive. So, Jahansev and Dapo, over to you so we can hear your overview of what's going on in the UAE.
Julia, thank you very much for the very kind introduction. It's our pleasure to be here. We're excited to share our thoughts. It's a very interesting topic and has been an interesting topic earlier as well. And obviously what's happening in the crypto and blockchain arena has become more and more interesting over the course of the year. So again, it's an absolute pleasure. We'll quickly go into the United Arab Emirates as a jurisdiction. There is a significant complexity, I guess, in how the regulatory regimes are set up and how they are addressed. So what we need to do is give you the context here on how the UAE is structured. And then there is confusion around Dubai, Abu Dhabi, whether Dubai is a country or a city, whether Abu Dhabi is a country or a city or different emirates and so on and so forth. So we want to lay that out first so you have clarity of context and how the different regulators are set up and which has what jurisdiction. And then we can dive into, and Dapo will do that with each jurisdiction. So hopefully this will make sense and we look forward to all your questions. Please do ask anything that comes to mind. Regardless of how complex or how politically you think it is, we'll be as open as we can be to answer your question. So moving on to the basics, what is the UAE? So United Arab Emirates basically came into being in 1971. Prior to that, it was basically seven states, which I will explain to you in the next slide, that were independently operating under the protection of the British Empire. And in 1971, basically the founder of Abu Dhabi or the ruler of Abu Dhabi, Sheikh Zayed bin Nayan, brought the rulers of the other six emirates together and then agreed to form the United Arab Emirates. Oil, I'm sure most of you would know, was discovered in the 60s in the UAE and the 40s and 50s in the in Saudi Arabia. So that obviously led to some oil wealth in Abu Dhabi, particularly. Dubai had some oil in the 70s and 80s, but that was very small reserves. The setup basically in the UAE from a government standpoint is that the president generally is from the Abu Dhabi. So effectively the ruler of the country is from Abu Dhabi and the prime minister is from Dubai. So if you currently look at the setup, Mohammed bin Zayed, who's the son of Sheikh Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan, is currently the president, and Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum is the prime minister of the UAE. So that's how it generally has been and is likely to continue in that fashion. It's a federal system of operation similar to the US. Basically, each independent state here, and I'll go into the states again, operates generally with reasonable autonomy on the laws and regulations that they need to implement within the states. However, the federal government provides overall coverage in relation to monetary policy, defense, and foreign policy. So very, very similar to how the U.S. operates in the structure element. As I mentioned, there are seven states. So Abu Dhabi is the capital. Abu Dhabi is also a city, which is an island city. Abu Dhabi, the state, has another city called Al Ain. Then you have Dubai, which is also an emirate and a city. Dubai has a smaller city called Hatta. Then we have Sharjah, which is a state and a city, Ajman, which is a state and a city, and Al Quwain, Ras Al Khaimah, and Fujairah, which are also city-states. And each of them have their own rulers. Each of them have their own provincial or state setup. And how they run the state. UAE's oil wealth, as I mentioned, resides mostly in Abu Dhabi, as you would note from the sovereign wealth funds. Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, which is obviously the $700 billion or $800 billion sovereign wealth fund, which is one of many. Then there is Mubadala Capital and Mubadala, which manages around $250 to $300 billion. There are a couple of other smaller sovereign wealth funds. So the total wealth of the UAE generally is between $1.5 to $2 trillion from a sovereign wealth point of view. In Abu Dhabi, access to destinations is through Etihad Airways. So there's a lot of people who will come to Abu Dhabi and travel in and out. There's reasonably good infrastructure in terms of schools, entertainment and hospitals, which is a very key element in attracting talent. And this is one of the reasons why you will see a lot of crypto firms moving. It's one thing to set up a regulatory framework to attract firms, but then it's a whole another matter in terms of setting the social and civil infrastructure around it to attract the people to actually make a city or a state their home. So they've done a reasonably good job there. Abu Dhabi is generally slower paced than Dubai. I've given an example here. So if you've been to the US or you would consider Abu Dhabi as Chicago, which is vibrant, but still a little bit slow, slower than New York. And New York is extremely fast paced. So Dubai would be New York and Abu Dhabi would be Chicago in comparison to the pace of life. And as most of you, I'm sure, are familiar, Dubai is the commercial center of the UAE. It has probably the highest profile globally in terms of the city or the state that is most known in the world. Again, the strategic initiatives taken by the rulers of Dubai were the Emirates Airline that was set up in 1984, I believe, or 85. And they set up a port, which was in the early 80s, et cetera. So with those two key infrastructure elements, they obviously have been able to significantly improve the profile of the city state. Again, in terms of infrastructure, I would definitely say that Dubai's infrastructure is bar none and matches any city in the world, probably I would say the best. Compared to most cities in the world, which is one of the key reasons why you will see a lot of interest in people wanting to move to either Dubai or Abu Dhabi because of the availability, because of the travel convenience, being in the Middle East, being able to travel west to Europe and east to Asia and so on. Just to give you a bit of perspective on how it looks like on a map. So if you look at it, the color yellow represents Abu Dhabi, and the red dots on the screen is the city of Abu Dhabi. The state of Abu Dhabi is all in yellow, and the oil reserves are south of, you know, where the straight line is. That's where most of the oil reserves and oil fields are. When you move up, you come to Dubai, which is in brown color. And Dubai has obviously certain aspects to it, which I'll come into shortly. And then you have the other states that you have. So this is how the UAE map looks like. It's not a large country when it comes to basically going from north to south. However, there's a large piece of the desert, which you see in yellow. Most of that is a desert, and that's where the oil reserves are held. Now, in Abu Dhabi, you will have the federal government offices there. The Central Bank of the UAE, which is the lender of last resort, is in Abu Dhabi. The Capital Markets Regulator, which is the Securities and Commodities Authority, has a head office in Abu Dhabi with an office in Dubai. And then you have the Abu Dhabi Global Market, which is a financial free zone, which is in an island within Abu Dhabi, which is is also obviously in the state of Abu Dhabi. Then you have Dubai. Dubai has the Dubai International Financial Center, which is well known globally. Recently, the Dubai government has set up the Dubai World Trade Center, which has the virtual assets regulatory authority, which is a new authority established in earlier this year. So we have a few regulators looking at the virtual assets regimes in the country, which leads to a few questions around who has what jurisdiction, what cross-border implications are there, can we do business globally, can we do business locally, and how would each regulator look at our business model, and there are questions around regulatory arbitrage, et cetera. So I think the idea of the webinar is to give the participants an opportunity to ask questions. And we'll hopefully be able to clarify any confusion that you have. So with that, I will pass on to my colleague Depo to go over specific regulatory regimes. Depo, over to you, and I will move the presentation for you.
Many thanks. Very many thanks, Julia, for the introduction and Jehanzeb for that nice bit of context on the UAE as a country, which sets us nicely into understanding the various regulatory regimes we have. And thanks to everyone who's joined the session. So I'll get straight into the thick of things. I think the key benefit from the session is really having you ask questions. So if you kindly move to the next slide so that I can talk through that. As Jehanzeb mentioned, there are various components of the country. UAE and similar applies to the various regulatory bodies that cut across the various key locations. I'll be speaking to each of those, namely the Abu Dhabi Global Markets, which is based in Abu Dhabi. There's the DWTC, which is the Dubai World Trade Center, as well as the Dubai International Financial Center, both in Dubai. Those are established in what we call free trade zones. And then I'll talk about the Securities and Commodities Authority, which is on the mainland UAE and, of course, the Central Bank. Looking at the ADGM, so the Abu Dhabi Global Markets is a center in Abu Dhabi, as I said, established in 2015 and has its own Registration authority, which deals with the commercial side of things within the free zone, as well as the financial services regulatory authority, which then does all the financial regulations. Specifically on the topic for today, the FSRA regulates digital assets, which comprise of both the digital securities as well as the virtual assets. The crypto assets framework was launched in 2018 and was renamed the virtual assets shortly afterwards. It is of all the regulatory authorities within the UAE, the most established regulatory regime. I think it's fair to say that the FSRA was the first financial regulator that was bold enough to actually implement a framework and have something in place that covered the entire spectrum of digital assets. And I think even in saying that, it is worth explaining how those fall into two buckets, because you have the digital securities, which exhibit the characteristics of a security. And then you've got the virtual assets, which is looked upon more as a commodity, but I'll go into that in a bit more detail. Now, as I was saying, the FSRA is far more established than the other entities, having been in place since about 2018, which explains the somewhat conservative approach to date. Again, something I would elaborate on. But if you are setting up in the ADGM, or you intend to set up in the ADGM, there are four key ways that can be done. First is setting up purely as a virtual assets. Exchange, and here they describe that as being a multilateral trading facility where you have the price discovery, or you could come in and operate as a typical virtual asset intermediary, which is what we're kind of more accustomed to in the traditional a conventional space where they either act as virtual asset brokers, virtual asset managers, or custodians. And it's very common within the, particularly within those who seek the MTF permissions, to also have a custodian license. The VVA aspect of things, obviously, although I say quite similar to the traditional counterparts, more conventional counterparts, focus on key three, on about four risk areas: financial crime, consumer protection, technology governance, and custody arrangement. So for anyone who's looking to play in the virtual asset space, those are four key areas that you need to be fully developed and abreast of in making that move. Other aspects that are covered are obviously derivatives and funds that are investing directly in virtual assets. And the FSRA also has a framework for fiat tokens or stable coins, as they are better known. With the stable coins, that could fall under the payment services regime. As you know, with what has happened more recently with Terra, the FSRA has stepped away from any form of algo stable coins. Stable coins traded that are accepted within the FSRA has to be backed one-to-one by a particular currency, that is, say, the dollar or any other currency that is determined. It has to be fully backed one for one. Now, I suppose the interesting thing for anyone who also then wants to play in the marketplace is, say, you know, what are the key things that I need to be aware of in wanting to set up? You know, as I did mention, the FSRA being the first mover in the regulatory space that continues to attract a lot of attention, but I suppose by and large, many regulators are still taking a very cautious approach. And this has led to them having a very conservative approach towards the licensing of firms within the center. And as such, they have what they call an accepted virtual assets regime, right? So it means that I'll give an example. Bitcoin, Ethereum, Cardano, for example, are well-known tokens. But even though they're well-known, you know, the FSRA has an approach where you need to demonstrate that you have the key systems and controls for any tokens you will be listing. The key variants in that, in making sure is the token you want to list, is it properly capitalized? What's the security around that? Traceability is a very, very big factor in wanting to accept and approve a virtual asset. Just trying to determine what type of DLT, distributed ledger, you'll be using, the innovation around that, and just making sure that there's a practical application for the token you want to list. You know, the FSRA, we've seen in the more recent times, taking a slightly different approach when it comes to licensing. In the past, it was that the process was for you to engage with the FSRA, you prepare an application form, and then you go through a series of demonstrations of your technology in satisfying. And when you satisfy all those requirements, you get an in-principle approval, which once satisfied, you then get the license. But we've seen a change in tact from the FSRA, where then what they want to see now is to actually review your technology. So you need to have your technology in place first. And then on the back of the acceptance of the technology you have, and that goes from, you know, the trading platform itself, your custody arrangements, the security around the technology, the governance around the technology. Once all of those things have been satisfied, and importantly, obviously, the issues around financial crime, once all of those have been satisfied and they tell you to, you're then given the go ahead pretty much to submit your application form. At that stage, you're reasonably comfortable that your application is likely to go through, and we've seen that change in approach, and the maturity of the FSRA is also depicted by the recent release of the supervisory arrangements, where they've made it very clear what supervisory arrangements they will have in place for any market participants. Again, as we all know, crypto is very fast moving. We've seen all different types of business models being proposed to the FSRA. One of those is for NFTs, where we've seen in May 2022 this year, they closed the consultation for NFTs. And we expect that by the year end, there'll be further release of the final publication on that. Jehanzeb, if you kindly move on to the next slide, just so that I can talk through the Dubai World Trade Center. So the Dubai World Trade Center, for many who've been keeping a close tab on what's happening in the UAE, would have heard about the Virtual Assets Regulatory Authority. This is the newest authority which was set up, and it's in line of the vision of the UAE and Dubai in particular to become what I will call the capital of crypto. And so the Dubai Virtual Assets Regulatory Authority, which I will call VARA, has been set up and have moved somewhat aggressively in attracting the key market participants to come to Dubai, and what we've seen is the launch of a cohort of sorts where they've invited about 50 to 60 of the biggest players that cut across various elements of the crypto world. So whether that's crypto exchanges, crypto brokers, Web3, the metaverse, banking, just bringing the different market participants together, and they've gone through this process wherein they are then leveraging on the experiences that they're gathering and the information that they're gathering from this cohort, almost if you think about a sandbox type approach, such that will then form the basis for the regulations which we expect to see in Q1 2023. Now, an interesting question you might ponder on is how has that been done? I suppose that's taking on a lot of best practice from existing regulators and using that as a basis to provide this cohort participants with certain basic thresholds that they have to fulfill. And like I said, for most of the participants in this cohort, these are well established entities rather than your startups. And so I suppose you might almost look at it as the entities have as much to lose as the regulators themselves, but it gives them the VARA a really good insight into exactly what their regulatory framework is going to be. So that is truly going to be an interesting space come around Q1 2023, when we're likely to see the legal framework formally put in place. Next slide, please, Jehanzeb. The Dubai International Financial Center. Now, the DIFC has been the longest serving financial center in Dubai. Set up in 2003. It's been long serving for the financial community when it comes to the free zones. But when it comes to the crypto space, I suppose, like I mentioned earlier on, each regulator is evaluating the risks and using that as a basis to determine how quickly or how cautiously they want to get into that space. The DIFC have earlier this year published a consultation paper, and we expect that these regulations will be released sometime in Q1 2023. We've had, as a firm, we've had recent conversations with the DFSA, and we know that they are likely to be more conservative than even the VARA and ADGM. So we know, for instance, that DIFC as a center will be looking at the more established businesses, right? So the expectation that they will be entertaining startups in their ecosystem is very minimal now. And so, as a starting point, they'll be looking to at established institutions And more importantly, because this is important information for anyone who's thinking about setting up anytime soon, is the fact that they will be only allowing a limited number of tokens to be traded by any one entity that is going to be set up in the center. Next slide, please, Jehanzeb. The UAE mainland, we've got two key regulators there now, the Securities and Commodities Authority, the ESCA. They regulate the capital markets business as well as commodities business. It has a federal remit, and again, this is where the peculiarities of UAE as a country and the various components of the financial system can be quite intriguing. Is that when you're on the mainland, the mainland regulators are different from the DIFC and the ADGM and the DWTC that are in the free zone. ESCA themselves, as a regulator, have published their own virtual assets regime. Cryptocurrencies are also considered as commodities, and as such, it come under the purview of the authorities. But to date, we haven't seen any crypto or virtual asset licenses. I know that we were quite closely involved in a lot of the consultation that was done at the time. And so as the market continues to evolve, whether that is a regulator that new participants will go to, or they will continue to gravitate towards the more established regulators, will be left to see. And of course, there's the UAE Central Bank, similar to any central bank for the conventional counterparts, act as the lender of last resort. They regulate the banks, leasing companies, payments and money exchange businesses. And I think it touches to a large extent that early last year, they also then released their stored value facilities regulation, which then makes references to crypto and virtual assets within the space of what they cover, particularly as it impacts potentially payment services, and so they have their own slant on the oversight of virtual assets, and where a wallet, because ultimately if you're dealing in virtual assets, there's the crypto side to it, and there's the fiat element to that. And so there's a very high likelihood that, once you have the fiat wallet and this has been offered to the clients, you'll need to get your store value facility license, which obviously requires an IT security assessment. The IT security assessment, I think, is worth mentioning, cuts across all the regulators also, because even in the ADGM and elsewhere, one of the things that the regulators want to see is some form of independent assessment of your operational readiness. And so your operational readiness will not only be impacted by the people, it will also be by the systems. And that's the central bank concept. Now, I'll pause there for now, but hopefully that's given you an insight into the various regulators within the UAE as a whole, specifically split into Dubai and Abu Dhabi. But I'm sure there'll be questions that border around, what does it mean for me if I want to set up an exchange, and what's the process like? And I think that's why we have some time for the questions, so that we can get into the nitty gritty of what it is to be, yeah. But I'll also hand back to Jehanzeb just to add to anything that needs to be flagged at this stage.
Thank you, Dapo. Really appreciate that. So I think I just want to basically put all of the regulatory regimes into context for our listeners here. And so the main thing is generally around whose jurisdiction is where. So just to highlight that for everyone. So the financial free zones, which are the Abu Dhabi Global Market and the Dubai International Financial Center. So the Dubai Financial Free Zone and the Abu Dhabi Financial Free Zone If you look at their legislation, they both say that you can do business in or from the financial center. And that effectively means that you can do business within the financial center or from the financial center to anywhere in the world. Now, what they have not done and what they will never do is to tell you what you need to do when you're doing business from the financial center. You have to obviously comply with or take a view of if you are providing financial services to your clients who are not within the financial center. So if you're in Dubai, for example, and you have Saudi clients, or if you have clients in Abu Dhabi, or if you have clients in Hong Kong, what do you need to do? That is to be determined by yourselves. The regulator has their rules and they would want you to comply with their rules, but they don't focus on the cross-border element. When it comes to the central bank and Securities and Commodities Authority, obviously their keen interest is in protection of the retail side of the market. So that's where their focus is. However, the regulators, both the regulators are operating slightly differently than what you would see as the regulators within Dubai International Financial Center and ADGM. They're more conservative. They are slower moving, if I can say that, and more conservative in their approach. Dubai World Trade Center and the Virtual Asset Regulatory Authority is there to expedite the adoption of crypto and attracting crypto firms and crypto talent to Dubai. And they're obviously a bit more aggressive in their approach, which is quite obvious from the fact that they've created a cohort of 50 to 60 firms, and they are experimenting with the regulations within that cohort before they publish those. So that's the context. Hopefully it makes sense. And then I will pass it back to Julia. And if there are any questions, we're more than happy to answer those.
Thank you very much, Jahan Zebandapo. That's a fascinating overview. It's absolutely fascinating to hear the overlay of these different regulators who appear from the outside to compete with each other. Is that how you think it works? I mean, it seems like a huge advantage to be able to sort of go to almost like a supermarket of regulators that you can choose from here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the idea has always been, if you look at the UAE and particularly Dubai, has always believed in setting up free zones that bring together the ecosystem of a particular industry, right? So financial free zone brings in all the ecosystem players within financial services to come together and create an environment that is beneficial for the participants, right? So, and then the reason for having, obviously, there's some legacy regulators and there are some new regulators, and rather than trying to change a legacy regulator to do new things, which I'm sure all of us on the call would agree that it's a significantly harder thing to do, they've also realized that and set up new regulators to address the pressing challenges. You know, it's very, very hard to move a huge oil tanker very, very fast. But if you set up a smaller boat, you can get to your destination rather fast. So that has been the premise for the financial free zones on one side. And the other one, obviously, is the infrastructure, right? So the ability that the tax breaks that have been given in financial free zones that are very relevant, which are not available if you are onshore or UAE mainland, which is a key element to that. And some of the regulatory restrictions in terms of amortization, which is employing UAE nationals, don't apply in free zones, but they do apply onshore. So there are a few considerations there that the government had put in place, and that's why they exist. Now, on the the other side is the confusion that this creates. So we basically have been for the last, I would say, 3 years answering pretty much similar questions about where do we go, what do we do, which place is the best place for us to go to? Can we access, you know, China, Hong Kong, Saudi Arabia, Middle East from a license here? So the answers are not easy, but they are clear, and they are all dependent on the risk appetite of the firm, but more importantly, what the commercial objectives are. So we always sort of look at the commercial objectives of our clients, their risk appetite, and then present to them, you know, the options that we think are best, and then let them make a decision and have a conversation and see where it goes.
Thank you. So one thing I thought it was fascinating that you said, Dapper, was that the entrants have as much to lose as the regulators in some of this. I thought that was a very interesting comment you made. And it sort of shows the sophistication, actually, of this level of regulation, I think, that you have in the UAE. But tell me, with all your regulatory experience with the FSA, now the FCA, how would you compare the regulatory approach in the UK to what you've seen in the UAE?
That's a really interesting question, considering I've been out of the FCA for a while now, but it still applies because, you know, ultimately regulators, no matter what the location is all about their reputation also, right? It is a business of trust, and they know that once it goes wrong with a particular venture entity that has significant impact, it rubs off on not just themselves as regulators, but also on the wider society. And I think the same applies as just here, which is why, I suppose, to a large extent, I think a few weeks ago, the FCA made an announcement on its approach to the crypto industry, but it hasn't quite gone as far as they have in the UAE and really focused more on the AML side of things, as opposed to, you know, the issues around conduct of business. So just allowing for a full blown crypto market, just the way it is in the conventional space. So I will say quite clearly, the UAE has a vision of, you know, what I described as being the capital of the crypto market. And I've taken that bold move. And that's what you see with the ADGM having been at the forefront of that. But Vara have even gone one step further in really attracting those 50 to 60 cohorts and saying, we will take a chance and say, actually, you operate, we will build our rules around what we see, knowing what best practice already looks like from other regulators globally, and use that as a basis to, I suppose, manage our regulatory, be pragmatic, but at the same time, I suppose, manage the regulatory risk. So it would really be interesting and fascinating to see what those regulations look like when they're out.
Yeah, and I think it's impressive that they've got such a big cohort of quite significant players, because it must be a two-way street as to what the regulators are actually learning from them as well. And that can't happen unless there really is confidence on both sides and a lot of trust. I think it's very impressive. So just to jump into some more nitty-gritty questions, how long would it take to set up a crypto broker or exchange in each of the main jurisdictions that you've been referring to, roughly?
I'll take that, Jehan Zeba, and then you can jump on that.
I have understood from this webinar that the answer to every question is about 10 questions, right?
Yeah, I know, right? I mean, it's an interesting one, right? Because I mean, from our experience, you have two types of market participants. You have those established entities, and you have the entirely new projects, right? And many a times, because a lot of even the most well-established entities are coming from unregulated environments, there isn't that full understanding of what it actually takes to be regulated. And so, you know, everyone comes and they say to Jehan Zeb, we want to get this regulated yesterday, and we know you've got the magic wand, but it doesn't work quite like that. So, I mean, for a broker, I will say it will take that is well-established and has fully functional technology and is responsive to queries and questions. It will take somewhere within 6 to 9 months easily.
6 to 9 months, yeah.
Six to nine months.
And do they have to have an operation in the UAE in order to go through that process? Or can it be set up at some other point? Or what are the requirements there?
Yeah, sure. So in terms of the process itself, so the first leg of the process for a broker is to, obviously, they engage consultants like ourselves. We engage with the FSRA. We submit a regulatory business plan that is reviewed by the FSRA. Obviously, regulators always have additional questions. And then we submit a full application That includes making sure that we have considered all the fitness, we understand the source of wealth of the backers, who are the shareholders, etc. And then once the FSRA reviews that, or the regulators review that, they issue what is called an in-principle approval, which is a list of requirements for the firm to fulfill. Once that is completed, it is only at that stage that they give you the license. So until the FSP is granted, and the IPA will have things like, you know, having the requisite people in place, your external auditor, having a bank account, having an office. Once all of that has been fulfilled, you get the FSP. And it is not until you get the FSP that you can actually undertake the regulated activity, right? So not until then can you undertake any activity from within the center.
Right.
So that's sorry to interrupt, but if I may, I think it's a very, very critical point here, right? So one of the key things, obviously, the longer it takes, the more it costs. And the less you know, the more it costs as well. So our advice always is that depending on the maturity of your technology and the maturity of your understanding to what Dapo was alluding before in terms of a regulatory process, that's very, very important, right? Yeah, there's an assumption sometimes made by firms that because we are doing a business, therefore we can do a regulated business, which is significantly challenged by the regulators in terms of the questions they ask and becomes a problem. So the key thing there is bank accounts are have been a huge problem globally for crypto businesses. They are not as big of a problem in the UAE now as they have been for the rest of the world. So which is a huge move to attract firms to the center, because obviously, initially you need to have some on-ramping from fiat to crypto and so on. So that's one. And two, the availability of the infrastructure. And what you asked about housing, so people need to be in the UAE. What you cannot do is have a person in the UAE and run a whole brokerage out of a different place. That would not fly. You'll have to have the mind and management and operations in the UAE for you to be able to receive a license and most importantly retain a license. Otherwise, it would be very, very difficult.
And is talent acquisition an issue, or Dubai is famously quite welcoming in terms of incoming talent? That must be a factor.
Yes. So talent, getting talent to Dubai is not a problem. It's very easy to get people to come and live in Dubai, and fantastic. I would say if I had to rank it, and I'm sure some people would disagree, probably Dubai would be at the top of the list for me in terms of convenience. Ease of living, et cetera. However, talent acquisition is a massive challenge for everyone. And I'm sure it's the same thing. So if you're looking for your developers, your technology people, huge challenge. If you're looking for compliance people in the crypto space, they are like gold dust. Very, very few people actually know what.
Dapo, you're worth your weight in gold.
I think Dapo is definitely worth his weight in gold. I'm probably more sort of silver here in my gold. But the important thing is planning properly. What we always advise our clients that the end result is significantly dependent upon proper planning. And if you don't do that, it will definitely end up costing you a lot more money than you think. And it will take significantly longer.
Right. So what do you think are the main roadblocks that people encounter when they're applying for crypto licenses?
Dapo, you want to answer that one?
Yeah, I think the biggest one, which we've seen a bit of an ease in, is the bank account opening. That's always the biggest thing.
How long does that take normally to open a bank account, if it's even possible?
I can just on this one. Okay, so I think look, people are now, there are a few banks that are willing to open bank accounts. What, however, is, and I'm sure similar in Asia Pac as well, is that when you have complicated corporate structures that own the entity, the certification, notarization, attestation requirements become the real difficulty and challenge. And that can take 3 months just to get the documents attested, because they have to go to, and then so on and so forth. So where there are complex structures, we always advise our clients to start that process right away.
Yeah.
And the banks are quite keen on having a chat with potential clients and explaining to them, you know, what they would require from a bank account opening point of view. So there are two obviously types of bank accounts. There's a corporate bank account where the company will be placing capital if you're setting up a subsidiary. And the more important one, which is your client money account, if you're a broker or an exchange, where you will receive your client money. So the, obviously the first one comes first and the second one comes second. But if you don't get past the hurdle of the first one, the second one doesn't happen, right? Which has obviously direct commercial impact on your ability to do business.
Thanks. Thank you. Dapo, you were going to carry on with the other roadblocks.
Yes, I mean, the other one is clearly the technology, right? Mm. The technology is major, particularly. I mean, the good news is you can get a lot off shelf these days, whether that's for market surveillance, for your KYC solutions, off the shelf now. The biggest thing is really understanding what the technology requirements are and aligning that to, because sometimes clients say, I've got the technology, but are not cognizant of the specific regulatory requirements. And so there's a lot of tailoring that needs to take place in the background. And so it causes a bit of frustration on the clients because they think, I had the technology working, but hadn't really considered the regulatory side of things and what the impact of that will be. So I will see that as the two biggest things that cost the roadblocks.
Right, right. So you'll probably tell me how long is a piece of string, but I just wondered what the rough cost of applying for, say, a crypto exchange license might be. I mean, I know it can vary massively depending on what type of service provider and how big, etc. But roughly, what would be the range, do you think?
I like Jehan's up to talk about numbers.
I knew you were going to say that.
Okay. Fair enough. So I think that's definitely how long is a piece of string question. What I would say is that, look, for an exchange, the process is complex. And just to give you an idea, right, the regulators would typically ask you to put in 12 months of operating expenses as capital. Mm-hmm. So if you let's say have $4 million as your expenses, because you have to have a lot of people, technology, et cetera. So your capital requirement alone is $4 million plus the $4 million you need for your annual operating expenses. And then on top of that, you have to set aside the cost for setting it up, which is the corporate cost and all that. So typically it would basically, in this example, you're looking at between $9 and $10 million to set up an exchange. If you're operating expenses are $4 million. If your operating expenses are $2 million, which is, I would say that'll be a hard one to pull off, because the regulator will look at your numbers and they will question those numbers, saying what you're saying is not, doesn't make sense. I think $3 and $4 million is a reasonable number. Now for brokers, you're looking at about between $1.5 to $3 million as an average cost, but again, it can significantly vary, right? So just to give you some considerations for variance, if it's an established organization, so let's say there's an exchange in Hong Kong that is looking to set up a broker in Dubai, your expenses probably are going to be lower than $1.5 million. But if you are a broker and you want to move your operations from Hong Kong, for example, to Dubai, majority of your operations, then you're probably looking at about $1.5 to $3 million.
Right, right. And are we talking about US dollars?
Yes, exactly. Okay. I think pound is out of question nowadays. It's a bit.
So another question, can you comment perhaps, Jahanzeb, about whether there are any Sharia law compliant crypto assets in the UAE and whether this is a sort of growth trend? Because one could imagine that would be a huge market.
Yes. So we Whether they are currently, I don't think there are at this point. There are funds that would be managing Sharia compliant crypto assets per se, but there are is definitely a lot of demand, and there are firms looking to deploy Sharia compliant products. I guess the Sharia compliant aspect is dependent upon the project itself, right? So as most of you would know, that money cannot be treated as an asset in Sharia. So therefore, if it's purely seen as money, as fiat money, those crypto assets would not qualify as Sharia compliant assets. They'll have to be backed by some other thing. So there are several projects that are currently being worked on, a couple that we are looking into. And the important thing is, if you include Sharia, this is probably beneficial for the listeners here, you add to your market size quite a bit, because then you add all the Sharia compliant investors who would not be part of your investor profile or your client profile if you were only doing conventional crypto products. And that always gives a significant sort of impetus to the business in the Middle East, when you can offer both conventional and Sharia products.
Right, thank you. Actually, there's a question from somebody who's listening. What is the ownership structure required to operate in the UAE? Can UAE operating entities be 100% foreign owned? It used to be not possible unless in a free zone. It doesn't appear to be sector specific, but I guess we're talking about financial sector.
Yes, so there have been some changes now, so some good changes. As you rightly said, Julia, financial free zone, so DIFC and ADGM, you can own the entities 100%. Foreign owners can own that. Now, for payments businesses, particularly, we have seen under Central Bank, they have issued licenses where the entity is 100% owned by foreign nationals or foreign companies. So except for banking and maybe potentially leasing companies, they for capital markets businesses, they would potentially look at that as well. There was a law a couple of years ago that removed the Emirati ownership requirements in most of the sectors. So that has changed. But for the Dubai Virtual Asset Regulatory Authority, the Dubai World Trade Center is a free zone. So again, you can have 100% ownership, foreign ownership in that.
Right, thanks. So our virtual assets, I think you mentioned earlier, they are treated as securities in some circumstances, but how are NFTs generally categorized in the UAE, Dapo?
Yeah, so the consultation for that was out recently, and I think those have been looked at as commodities, if memory serves me right. But we're waiting for the final paper to be issued on that towards the end of the year, and that will give us some clarity on the position that the regulators will be taking on that.
Right, right. And is there anything, do you think, on the horizon in the UAE for further regulation of AML and CTF? Is that being tightened, or do you think the regime's pretty much in place now?
Well, as you know, the UAE as a country is on the grey list right now. Mm. So we're seeing a lot of good work being done by the authorities in terms of thematic reviews, surveys, training, additions to sanctions list on an ongoing basis. I've probably received about three or four already today, including the need to attend a mandatory training. So the UAE as a country, absolutely, the UAE as a country is working aggressively to ensure that systems and controls across the board are revamped. And you can imagine it is a challenge. On the one hand, you have an industry where people tend to, from a perception perspective at least, is that crypto is heavily linked to financial crime, although the academic studies will suggest otherwise also, that there's probably more in the conventional space. But hey, perception counts for a lot these days. So yeah, there's a lot of work that continues, and I think that will continue to be an evolving space, right? Because the guys who do these things get smarter all the time. So the regulators have to also keep pace with that. So I don't think that's going anywhere anytime soon.
Right. And do you think the regulators across the UAE will cooperate in relation to this? Is that happening? on Yeah.
Absolutely, we're seeing a lot of that. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, reporting that is done in the UAE now is somewhat centralized. We have to do our reporting through a centralized system and copy your, you know, I suppose, localized regulator so that all of that is being compiled in one place. So definitely a lot of coordinated efforts going on.
Right, right. And finally, what do you think is in the pipeline for 2023 in relation to VASP frameworks in the UAE? Do you think there's anything exciting on the horizon, or do we have to wait and see till we see these consultation conclusions?
No, I think we will continue to see an involvement. It's going to continue to evolve. There are one or two interesting things, and Jehanzeb might want to expand on that, that will actually escalate the visuals around, you know, blockchain and crypto generally, but from an education perspective and just getting more people involved. Because I think once there's mass adoption, this is going to become mainstream very soon. You know, 2 years ago, we probably would not have been having this discussion, but this is becoming more mainstream. And there's a lot of work in the background going on that would explode that even further.
I think a couple of points I want to add, Julia, here. So there was a metaverse assembly that the Dubai government held here, right? So the whole event you can attend in person or in the metaverse. They are very aggressively promoting the metaverse, at least in Dubai and generally in the UAE. And obviously financial services are part of the metaverse. So they are, there'll be interesting developments in that space as to who regulates who within the metaverse, which is quite interesting if you think about it. So that definitely will happen. There are a couple of sort of key things happening. There are some in Abu Dhabi, particularly there's Abu Dhabi Finance Week in November, which is going to have a crypto day on November 16th, which is, I think, for the listeners here, if they can attend online, that would be a wonderful thing for them to see. And then there are other initiatives happening, some crypto and blockchain associations being set up and to promote the ecosystem, et cetera. So you know, things are going to continue to move. I think the UAE is very keen on getting on with the program and attracting a lot of talent. The baseline for that is, and I'll give you the sort of the politics behind it, is that if the UAE gets to about 16 million people, 16 million people in population, that would be reasonably good from a population point of view for the UAE for the next 10 years. And then there are other numbers beyond that, right? So in order to get to 16 million, it's about 11 or 12 million now. That's 4 million people. And the way to attract that is obviously be heavily involved in the new trends, again, attracting Gen Z and others to the UAE. And you were seeing also the relaxation of the residence visas, the golden visas, employment and immigration matters, which all is aimed at attracting people to the UAE. So UAE is definitely open and welcoming everybody in this space. They want the right type of firms and the right type of projects to progress. And there's a lot of venture capital available. The governments are supporting that. The federal government have VC funds that are supporting crypto and blockchain. And we work with the governments and their VC arms quite a bit on certain elements. So I think for the listeners, if they're looking at the UAE, the ecosystem is definitely in shape to support whatever plans they have for the Middle East.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, I think it's around an hour we've been going strong. So Jehanzeb and Dapo, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing so much about this dynamic crypto world and everything else that's dynamic in the UAE. And we're looking forward to hearing more about exciting developments. So we hope I can catch up with you again in the not too distant future. I hope you all enjoy the rest of the day, and I hope to see you again all soon. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.